This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. After being dormant for decades, the musical Bye Bye Birdie suddenly is current again. Its film version figured prominently in a recent episode of the period TV series Mad Men. And the stage musical itself, with music by Charles Strauss and lyrics by Lee Adams, is being revived on Broadway for the first time since its 1960 premiere. It's a show about an Elvis-type singer who stages a publicity stunt to meet a member of a local fan club. From the original Broadway cast, here are Dick Gauthier as pop star Conrad Birdie and Susan Watson as his lucky fan, singing A Lot of Livin' to Do.
There are chicks just ripe for some kissing, and I mean to kiss me a few. Man, those chicks don't know what they're missing. I got a lot of living to do. Sizzling steaks all ready for tasting, and there's Cadillacs all shiny and new. Gotta move, 'cause time is a-wasting. There's such a lot of living to do.
There are men of 19 or 20 who are suave and reckless and true. Older men who give a girl plenty. I've got a lot of living to do.
There's music to play, places to go, people to see, everything for you and me. Crazy clothes and motorboat races.
A Lot of Livin' to Do, one of the songs in Bye Bye Birdie. The Roundabout Theater production revival, starring John Stamos and Bill Irwin, opens next week on Broadway. To note the occasion, we're revisiting Terry's 1994 interview with Charles Strauss, who wrote the music for Birdie, and for the musicals Applause, Golden Boy, and the mega hit Annie. They started by talking about Broadway's original Bye Bye Birdie, which starred Dick Van Dyke, Cheetah Rivera, and Paul Lynde, and featured such songs as Kids, Put on a Happy Face, and Honestly Sincere.
I had to tell you, I was listening to the album again last night, and I hadn't heard the score in a long time, and I was just shocked to realize that I remembered words to songs when I'd completely forgotten the song existed, like Normal American Boy. I mean, I haven't thought about that song in years, and I realized, God, I know all the words to this. And I bet so many people have that reaction when they hear songs from Bye Bye Birdie.
Yes, fortunately they do. It's a very, very much performed show. At the time, Lee Adams and Mike Stewart and I wrote it. We wrote it because it was offered us, you might say. We would have written, I guess, almost any show that was offered us. It actually wasn't even in that shape. It was just to be a show about teenagers. But had we realized that it would have that kind of commercial clout, that is, that high schools and camps and prisons, I don't know, everybody does it. It's incredible. And it keeps picking up in performances. I think we would have said, oh, let's do that show. But at the time, it was just... It was actually even a little strange. It was a bit of an embarrassment in a funny way to me and to Mike, because, well, to me particularly, because I had I'd been in serious music all my life. I'd studied classical music. I was embarking on a serious music career, that this would be the first opportunity that I'd have for a major public hearing. And then that we had this silly name, Bye Bye Birdie, it was not the show that I wanted to write, which taught me something about myself, which is I don't know where the hell I am half the time.
Let me ask you about writing the telephone hour from Bye Bye Birdie. And this is a series of phone conversations that the teenagers are having with each other. And it's not a straightforward song. I mean, you're basically setting a series of conversations to music with little interruptions and phones right. ringing. So what were some of your considerations when you were writing the music for that?
Well, you know, before I just answer that, I have four kids, and it's come back to haunt me because I have four telephone lines, and it's still every second everybody's on the phone. Anyway, beside the point, my considerations were, first of all, that it was rock, and of its sort, it is rock music, though such an innocent sort that, you know, I don't like to listen to it and say I'm Mick Jagger or anybody like that. But it was rock, and I paid attention very strongly to the guitar chords, you know, that all guitarists play on it. You know, a lot of rock music in those days particularly was very, I don't want to say simple because that wouldn't, that would be a little bit derogatory, but there were certain patterns. It became patterned in a way, and I did model it on that. But then I used a lot of... I used a lot of changes of time and a lot of interjections, which is into the exact rock beat. But I kept the beat going very much, and then I used Lee and I sat and kind of carved it out together, high and you know the things. Did they really get pinned?
Well, here's the telephone hour from Bye Bye Birdie, music by my guest Charles Strauss.
Johnson, can I speak to Penelope Ann?
You know about Kim.
Penelope?
I just knew it somehow.
About the prom?
I must call her right up.
Saturday?
I can't talk to you now.
The Telephone Hour, from the original cast recording of Bye Bye Birdie. The cable series Mad Men built a plot line around Bye Bye Birdie earlier this season, when some of the copywriters for the advertising agency were eager to copy a scene from the film version to help sell a new Diet Cola called Patio. The idea was to hire someone to sing directly to the camera, all bubbly and full of sex appeal, as Anne Margaret had done playing a teenaged fan in the film version. But one member of the team, Peggy, played by Elizabeth Moss, doesn't like the idea as much as the men in the room.
Is there more?
I love her.
I saw Susan Watson do it on Broadway, and she was great. But she didn't have that.
Well, it's not going to be her. But they want that scene frame for frame, as they say.
So, something about how desperate she is for a Pepsi?
It's for Pepsi, but it's not for Pepsi. It's called Patio. and it's a dieter's kind of Pepsi to help women reduce. It's Pepsi's Diet Right Cola, and there's claims that their lawyers went over calories, etc. If we do it right, we land patio, and if we land patio, I'll be at lunch with Pepsi.
I think Pete Campbell just broke a sweat.
I'm coming to casting.
We're going right to casting?
You don't have to if you don't want to.
I understand why. You like this, but it's not for you. I'm the one who'd be buying patio.
You're not fat anymore.
Thank you. Let's assume we can't talk them out of the name. And let's assume we can get a girl who can match Anne Margaret's ability to be 25 and act 14.
Is that what she's doing?
Is it just a knockoff? Are we allowed to make fun of it at least?
She's fun and sexy. Don't be a prude.
Would you say that to me?
It's sexy, and it's what they want.
Clients don't always know what's best.
When we land them, you can start talking to them that way.
A scene from the AMC series Mad Men, discussing a scene in the movie version of Bye Bye Birdie. We'll hear more of Terry's interview with Charles Strauss, who wrote the music for Bye Bye Birdie, after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1994 interview with Charles Strauss, composer of the music for Bye Bye Birdie. A Broadway revival of the musical opens next week.
You studied with Nadia Boulanger. Did she give you any advice about pop music versus classical music?
Well, oddly enough, she did. This woman was the great musician of our generation in many ways, and her greatness was that she was a master analyst, not only of music but a psychoanalyst in her own way. And she used to hear the music of her students, and she was able to isolate it. She was able to shine a spotlight on what was you and what was watered down Stravinsky. I remember when I worked with her, she asked to hear everything I'd written, and I played her my sonata and my concerto and various things, art songs and all that. And she said, well, what else? And I said, well, that's it. She said, well, no, what about, you know, your student pieces? And I played her some of them. And then anything else? And I said, well, there was my parents, who were never into serious music at all, though they were very proud of me. I used to come home from college and play them all these pieces that sounded like watered down Bartok, really, but it was very serious kind of things. I was really, you know, into it, and I could see they were proud of me, but they didn't really
respond.
Yeah, not really. I mean, I think so. My mother was just always so nervous for me. But I remember writing a piece that I considered my party piece that I could play that they could show off to my aunt. I had an aunt Stella, who she was hard of hearing to begin with, but it was she was over at the house a lot, and I wrote this piece, and it was really, you know, I look back at it today, kind of saucy or something. It was very lighthearted, and they loved it. Everybody liked it, so it became my piece, and I played that for her, which I very rarely, I didn't do that for anybody except, you know, a couple of relatives, and she said, well, what else? And I said, well, when my brother, he had been in the Navy, and when he came home from his first tour of duty, or his boot camp, whatever, I had written, I laugh because it was a funny moment in my life, and I said, I wrote this little song for him called Welcome Home, Able-Bodied Seaman Strauss, see? And she said, may I hear that? Oh, I said, I could. No, she said, please. And so there, with this venerable woman, I played this silly song. She said, I see. She said, anything else? And I said, this makes me laugh. I said, I used to go out with a girl. I really liked her. Her name was Janet. And we lived on the Upper West Side of New York. And I wrote this song, but it was a joke called Moon Over 83rd Street. She said, play this for me. Here I am in Paris, you know, with an intimate of Stravinsky's and every American composer that you could think of having studied with this great woman. So I played Moon Over 83rd Street. And she said, good. Now we go back to this, whatever. So we went back to... towards the end of my thing, she said to me something that nobody had ever said to me. She said that you have a great talent for light music.
May I make a request?
Sure.
Could you sing one of the songs that you played for her?
Wait a second. The Welcome Home, Mabel Montesquieu. What else? You heard that? No, I can't sing that one. Moon Over. Oh, Moon. This is the funniest interview I've ever done. Moon Over 83rd Street with shafts right below. A moon over 83rd Street, my heart's all aglow. You, Janet, in the lamplight, I hear something call. I hear something dull. I'm yours, body and soul. I think that was the last one. It was meant partly as a jest. I mean, but that was it. There's a first performance for you.
So, but it helped you. It helped you find out that that's what you should be doing. Is writing pop tunes.
That was her genius. That's why I can laugh at it. I can also laugh at it because I've had some successful shows. But her genius was really taking a young kid like me. I was quite young when I was there. I was around 18 or so, and I know from my own experience with my own children what it is to be searching for an identity. And she, in her soft, brilliant way, was able to contribute to my identifying who I was.
Mm-hmm. I want to close with the story behind one of your most famous songs, and this is the song from Annie, Tomorrow. Did you have to write in a range that you were confident a kid could sing?
Well, that's really an interesting question because yes and no. The yes is a part of my musical background. I know what kids' ranges and sopranos and tenors are. The no part is that I wanted to squeeze a little bit more out of them because the emotional part of the music is when kids sing high, they scream. You know, I did it in Bye Bye Birdie, and in Bye Bye Birdie, they sang notes in the telephone hour that they didn't think they could sing. And actually, I had learned a lot of that. I used to work for Frank Lesser. I was his assistant for 2 years. And I remember when Frank was testing people for range, he would often have them sing
from Bushel and a Peck.
From Bushel and a Peck. And because it was, he would put it in a key with the pianist that it would be out of their range. They had to go, but because they were making fun, they could or could not hit it. Had you said, sing that note legitimately in a song like, I don't know, If I Loved You or something, they would have said they can't reach it. But when they were playing these characters, they could. So I devised, it's not my own invention, but or maybe it is, I don't know. These kids would come in, and I would just have them sing Happy Birthday. Once they passed the other thing, I would have them sing a song that they didn't have to worry about anything. And so they would, Happy Birthday, Happy Birthday. See, and very often they found that they could reach notes which on their resumes they couldn't reach at all, and that was the sound I wanted. So I did write for that, and particularly in a song like Hard Knock Life and in Tomorrow, the song Tomorrow. And what happened was that at the very beginning, during our auditions, nobody could sing these songs. Today, every girl in the world sings them, which is it's a wonderful, actually, tribute to the psychology and any popularity the songs have.
Well, let me say it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Terry. For me, it's great.
Charles Strauss speaking to Terry Gross in 1994. The first ever Broadway revival of Bye Bye Birdie opens next week. Here's Charles Strauss himself, recorded at the Smithsonian in 1978, performing and telling a story about one of the famous songs from Bye Bye Birdie. I'm David B. Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
I just wanted to do a couple of songs that might show you some of the things that happened, which were a result of the staging or the underlying dramatics, the performers, the costumes. They all had an effect on these songs. First, there was a song that was in Bye Bye Birdie. It involved what we thought was a terribly clever idea. We had Dick Van Dyke, and there was a moment in the play in which he was very depressed and had to set up a television show, the Ed Sullivan Show, and he was working with the lighting man who was throwing different color spots on him, and he would be in and out of them dancing, singing in and out of these spots. He would also be able to express what was inside him and be able to dance, and it was a number right up Gower Champion's alley, who was the director. We couldn't miss with this number. A big hit, right? No, wrong. It was a real flop, and we couldn't understand it. For some reason, it didn't work. We thought there was nothing else to do but throw out the song, which is Lee's and my habit. We're very impatient with a song not working. But it was Marge Champion, Gower's then wife, who had what I thought was the corniest idea in the world, put it in a spot in the first act where he sang the song to two little girls who were very depressed at seeing their hero, Conrad Bertie, leaving for the army. But we tried it, and magically, it worked right away. And you could tell, this was a spot where the audience wanted to see Dick Van Dyke dance. They wanted to see this happen with two little funny, wonderful-looking girls who were depressed, and the number went on to become one of the great successes in the show. Anyway, here was the number.
Gray skies are gonna clear up, put on a happy face. Brush off the clouds and cheer up, put on a happy face. Take off that gloomy mask of tragedy, it's not your style. You look so good that you'll be glad you decided to smile. Pick out a pleasant outlook, stick out that noble chin.